Okay. Thank you for being here. I'm Roxana Witter. I'm in the Colorado School of Public Health. And my presentation is really going to go through the most recent, most of the most recent literature that I could find in the public health arena related to natural gas development. There's probably some articles that I left out, and they may be important ones. The Hill article I didn't cover in this talk, but what you'll see is that all of the articles are within the last couple years, with the exception of one. This is really a very, very, very new literature, and that's a good thing for the time limitations of the presentation, but not a very good thing for anything that we're attempting to do that would be based in science and in scientific knowledge. I don't have any disclosures. All right, you've seen one of these, and I'm just using this this diagram here, the one that you haven't seen on the left, just to demonstrate by a picture the difference between conventional natural gas and shale gas. On the very top left is the conventional natural gas well, which goes straight down into natural gas pocket. You can see that it's pretty shallow and straight, and the well that is next to it is meant to represent a shale gas well, and you can see it's much deeper and longer horizontally. And the implications of that is that there's a whole lot more potential industrial processes related to the longer, deeper well. And that's, there's really a lot of similarities too between conventional gas and shale gas. And in Colorado, we use the term unconventional gas because a lot of our gas that's been developed over the last several years isn't shale gas. Although we have shale gas, we also have other kinds of unconventional gas. So I tend to use unconventional gas too, whereas other people use shale gas. So I'm going to use this interchangeably. You've seen this other diagram. I've just put a very simple list of the hazards to public health as we've been thinking about them as chemical hazards, both chemicals entering into the water and into the air, physical hazards that can come from noise and traffic, and we could also list accidents and malfunctions under that category. And then community hazards related to population changes and physical changes to the community. And then finally, the psychosocial hazards that are related to stress that can come from real or, like was said, perceived hazards and the perception of hazard. And then there's susceptible populations, subpopulations that we should be thinking about. And these, what I've got listed here, really, you know, what we normally would consider to be susceptible subpopulations to environmental hazards. And because our list is so big, I think we can probably include any and all of these susceptible populations depending on what kind of environmental hazard we're concerned about. To think a little bit more specifically about the concerns about water, we know that the quantity is a concern. There's millions and millions of gallons that are used for both drilling and for hydraulic fracturing. And as you can remember from that first diagram, the unconventional or the shale gas will use more of it just based, if nothing else, on the length and depth of the well. The quality of the water, there's concerns about the compromise to quality, and those mostly from the chemicals that are associated with hydraulic fracturing, but also chemicals associated with drilling, and then the naturally occurring chemicals that are with the natural gas itself. And this could be hydrocarbons, it could be BTEX, benzene, ethyl benzene, toluene, and xylene, could be radioactive materials. And we're concerned about contamination of groundwater and surface water. And there's also concerns about the disposal of wastewater. The wastewater that is being used for the drilling then comes back very, very contaminated with all kinds of things, salts and metals, hydrocarbons and radioactivity. It can be sprayed on roads. or on land. It can be evaporated from pits, which has been probably more common in the West than in the East. Then you're left with the sludge at the bottom, and you can also have evaporation of volatiles coming from the pits. Discharge to stream beds, and this can be permitted and is permitted in several states. It can be, water has been sent to municipal wastewater treatment plants. This is no longer generally done, but there was a lot of concern about that. A lot of wastewater is injected into deep injection wells, which are EPA regulated, but this is where there's been linked to earthquakes related to the injection of wastewater into these wells. And then more recent, in the last couple years, there's been an increasing amount of commercial treatment of the wastewater, and this is being done by the industry and using this treated water for hydrofracking, so that they're actually starting to use less water and have less waste. And so this is a move in the right direction. In terms of air quality, there's concerns about air quality both on many levels on the site, and air quality for the workers. And I'm going to just have one slide on silica exposure for workers, and then Walter will talk about that a little bit more later. Then there's concerns about exposures near the pad, particularly for residents that live nearby, regional exposures including ozone, and then what was mentioned already, and I'll talk a little bit more about the global exposures related to methane. So as I said, the public health literature is really in its infancy. The first several papers that came out really were describing what the concerns were in the public health arena. So EHP had a news in their environmental health perspectives news. They did a review of the air, water regulatory concerns and the lack of health effect studies. There is Finkel did a commentary on hydraulic fracturing chemicals and talked about what's known and unknown and dangerous chemicals and the multiple pathways that there could be for exposure. Then in Gudiati, there was another paper talking about the scientific uncertainty related to this topic and began to talk about the risk-risk trade-offs and how climate change will probably be entering into this discussion, and we may have to talk about climate change versus local environmental degradation. And then Dr. Goldstein will be talking more about this, but in a paper in 2012 talking about the lack of public health experts in advisory commissions. Then as far as water quality, these are a couple of the papers that I was able to locate that began to address water quality, and this is the first one looking at methane concentrations in drinking water wells in an area where their natural gas was being developed, and their findings were that the drinking water wells that were closer to natural gas wells had higher levels of methane than the drinking water wells that were farther away from natural gas wells. Then the same group was found geochemical evidence for natural fractures between the shale gas formations in shallow aquifers, and indicating there could be an increased risk for contamination, especially for gases that could travel between these natural fractures. In Pavilion, Wyoming, the EPA was asked to evaluate the contamination of drinking water wells in an area that was where natural gas was being extracted. The EPA found that chemicals were found in the drinking water aquifer, and that these chemicals were consistent with the natural gas operations in the area, and that they found a variety of chemicals, both organic and inorganic chemicals, and you can see them listed over in the other column there. And that the natural gas activities likely enhanced gas migration to the aquifer as well. They said that it was probably, there could be two sources of contamination, deep sources, including wells that were not functioning proper, natural gas wells that were not functioning properly, or the fracturing itself could have been responsible for deep contamination, and also shallow source of contamination, meaning the pits that were on site, the waste pits. The industry disputed the findings and the interpretation of the findings. The USGS has gone in and repeated analysis from two sites, and they found essentially similar findings. They have refrained from interpreting the findings, and the public comment period is just closed on the EPA study, and so I guess we can anticipate at some point that there'll be a final report coming out on that. Another paper by a group in New York, published in 2012, they were looking at the likelihood of pathways for exposure from water contamination, and they did a risk analysis modeling five possible water contamination pathways, one of them being well casing failure, fracture migrations, surface contamination, transportation accidents, and waste disposal. And by their analysis, they found that waste disposal posed the highest risk for public health effects, and this was due to the fact that there's such a huge volume of waste, and the waste is so heavily contaminated that that they felt that this was really posed the biggest public health risk in terms of water exposures. And then one more study looking at the levels of arsenic and selenium in the actual shale formation, the actual Marcellus shale formation. And this group found that the levels were high, there were high levels of arsenic and selenium, and their concern, they raised the concerns that the hydraulic fracturing could actually mobilize these chemicals from the shale into the wastewater, causing an additional environmental and public health hazard. So now moving on to air contamination, and start out with the contamination that can happen on the work site. NIOSH went out and did an exposure assessment study. It was pretty extensive. They looked at 11 sites in several states, did 116 personal breathing full shift samples looking at silica levels. And what they found was almost half of their samples were over the OSHA PEL, and almost 80% of them were over the NIOSH REL, meaning that these silica exposures were extreme. And then a third of them were above levels that could be handled by a respirator. So even if workers were wearing a respirator on site, a third of the time, they weren't being protected, even with that kind of personal protective equipment. NIOSH and OSHA issued a hazard alert in June, and they're working with the industry to try and develop engineering methods to decrease these exposures. In terms of local air quality, McKenzie out of our group in Colorado did a health risk assessment. She used EPA screening assumptions for the health risk assessment and used 24 samples, air samples that were taken near a well pad, and 163 samples from ambient air in the natural gas development area, and found that there was an increased risk of subchronic and chronic non-cancer health effects. And there was also a slightly increased excess cancer risk. And the contributing chemicals are those listed there, aliphatic hydrocarbons, the BTEX chemicals, and 1,3-butadiene. really, the only health effects paper that I was able to identify was the one done by Bamberger, published in New Solutions in 2012. And what they did was look at a case series, 24 cases of animal owners in six different states, and they described the water, the suspected water exposures and air exposures that that these animal owners thought that their livestock and in some cases their pets had experienced, and then recorded the health effects of the animals, and also in some cases the humans or the owners also had health effects. And those health effects for the animals ranged from reproductive effects, milk production, and overall just poor condition of the animals in a variety of different ways, and also sudden death. And in the human effects, there was a variety of health effects in terms, including respiratory, neurological, skin, and GI effects. So now moving on to the regional air quality in Wyoming, and actually this is in a different area of Wyoming than the water study. There's been last several years, wintertime ozone levels that have been surprisingly high. Wintertime ozone was previously an unknown phenomena. We always think of ozone as being a summertime contaminant, but in Wyoming, the current belief is that, or current evidence is that what's happening is NOx, nitrogen oxides are being released from combustion from a variety of industry-related sources, including generators, flaring, trucks, and also then there's the volatile organic chemicals, which are the other part of the precursors for ozone, and this is coming from wells and tanks and compressors. And then there's the sunlight. There's a lot of sunlight in the wintertime in Wyoming, and snow reflection, and then inversions, which are contributing to 100 to 125 parts per billion ozone, and the NAAQS is 75 parts per billion. So this is dramatically high levels of ozone. There was a study in 2010 that looked at modeled the incremental increase of ozone that could be attributed to natural gas development in the Haynesville shale area. And what they did was use emission estimates for that area and modeled what the increase would be when ozone was already at 60 parts per billion, what would be the increase after that. And in some areas, in a high development, in a rapid development scenario, some areas in western Louisiana could see increases of up to 17 parts per billion due to the to the ozone precursors from the natural gas development. And then finally, this was already touched on a little bit, but the debate about climate change and the contribution of natural gas emissions to climate change. As was stated earlier, natural gas combustion provides significantly less carbon dioxide emissions, but methane is a much stronger greenhouse gas, and methane leakage can happen during extraction, processing, distribution, and also with inefficient engines, particularly engines in the transportation sector are not at this time very efficient, and a lot of methane can escape from those engines. Howarth in 2011, I'm not sure if his paper started the debate, but it certainly was a focus of bringing this topic to the forefront. And then after, and Howarth asserted that the shale gas could potentially have higher methane emissions than conventional gas development, and both would have higher emissions than coal. Others came out with different estimates based, mostly everybody has varying assumptions when they're doing these estimates. Alvarez in 2012, paper in PNAS, His modeling came up with the conclusion that natural gas was better in terms of a life cycle greenhouse gas emissions than coal for electricity generation, but worse than gasoline and diesel in the transportation sector, as was mentioned earlier. And this just shows how the change from coal to natural gas has decreased carbon emissions in all parts of the country and in some parts by a significant amount from 2008 to 2009. But methane does leak out of our distribution system, and this is a demonstration of methane leaks in San Francisco and in Boston. A company called Picaro can drive around and, as they're driving, identify methane leaks in the natural gas pipelines that are underneath our streets, and the height of the peak is related to the amount of methane that's being leaked. So we do know that methane is being emitted. We just don't know how much. And then finally, methane and other hydrocarbon emissions may be underestimated. These two studies reflect actual measurements of hydrocarbons in the atmosphere, and when they compare the measurements to emission estimates, the measurements are significantly higher than what the estimates, the emissions estimates have been used for a lot of the modeling studies that are out there. So the jury is still out, I think, on how much is actually being emitted into the atmosphere. I just wanted to mention three studies that are getting underway. There's probably more. University of Colorado in Boulder just got a big grant from National Science Foundation to look at air and water quality. They're also going to look at social science and human health, and we're going to work with them on the human health portion of it. And then using a lot of new technology and outreach and education to try and take a comprehensive look at the impact of natural gas development. Colorado State University is going to be looking at air emissions and dispersion during different stages of development, and that's going to happen in western Colorado. And then the Geisinger Health System in Pennsylvania is an integrated healthcare delivery system. They're going to be developing a longitudinal data set, and hopefully there'll be some epidemiologic studies that come out of that. I'm sure there will be, and that'll be a really rich data set for researchers to use. And that's all I have.
Thank you. I want to just take a couple of questions, but could you, earlier someone asked about earthquakes. You mentioned in your slide. Can you tell us anything more?
No, all I know is that as far as I understand it, the earthquakes seem to be linked to the injection wells.
Right, that's what I understand.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't tell anybody any more than that.
I'm going to repeat the question.
The question is anybody studying the impact of the to the food chain through livestock and crops? And there may be, I'm sure there are studies that are being developed out there that I'm not aware of. I really could only tell you about what's been in the literature so far. And maybe one of our other speakers will be able to answer that question.
Hi, I'm sorry, I missed you last time.
Has anyone made a demographic analysis of the people that are being impacted? And I see some heads that are nodding.
I was just thinking Kathy Brazier's survey.
Okay, so there's been some work being done in Pennsylvania. I think it depends on where you're looking. It may be very different in Pennsylvania than in North Dakota, than in Colorado or in Texas or in Louisiana or in Arkansas. I mean, there's a lot of plays going on all over the country, and those demographics may change from place to place, and the impacts may be different from place to place as well.
Really quickly.
I'm wondering, thanks for the overview, wondering if you could speak to the state of public health funding
our next speaker may just do that. Thank you. Thank you, Roxanne. That was fantastic.